Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 3rd of March. Our guest this hour writes a really intriguing article about the way we would like to live, the way we are living, and the problems associated with the way that we have been living. The article is "The Next Slum: The Subprime Crisis is Just the Tip of the Iceberg. Fundamental changes in American life may turn today's McMansions into tomorrow's tenements." This article is in the March issue of The Atlantic. And Christopher Leinberger is a land use strategist and developer, a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution in Washington. He focuses on research that helps transform traditional and suburban downtowns and other places that provide, and we'll use this term a lot this hour, walkable urbanism. He's a professor of practice and director of the Graduate Real Estate Development Program at the University of Michigan, where he trains the next generation of real estate developers in the building of sustainable, walkable urban places. He's a founding partner of Arcadia Land Company, which is dedicated to land stewardship and building a sense of community. And he is author of The Option for Urbanism, Investing in a New American Dream, and Strategic Planning for Real Estate Companies. He's written for a number of publications and has been profiled by all kinds of TV and radio networks and has been a visiting lecturer at a number of places, including the University of Wisconsin-Madison. We'll be welcoming phone calls. We'll have many, I think, on this topic as we look at McMansions and suburbs and urban areas and how it is we want to live and what's happening. That's what's dramatic about this article, is what's happening in terms of physical and social disorder in many of these starter suburban areas and some that are pretty upper end. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. Hello, Christopher.
How are you, Kathleen?
Fine, thanks. How are you?
Very well.
Good. I was really struck at the beginning of the article when you talk about the signs of physical and social disorder in all of these communities from, you know, North Carolina to California. It's evidently pretty prevalent. What's going on and why is it happening?
Two major reasons. One is that suburban neighborhoods that are just residential are very fragile creatures, that they do very well when they're growing and when values are appreciating. But when they stop growing, and especially when values begin to creep downward, that you can have the situation where property tax and other tax revenues are falling and social problems are going up, and it becomes a very difficult situation to handle because you have very few financial options. But the major reason behind this is that we in real estate have managed to once again overbuild a particular kind of product.
Hmm.
And I always like to say that we in real estate can overbuild any market, no matter how good. But this time, it's a structural overbuilding. And it's a structural overbuilding of the drivable suburban product type that is going to probably take us decades to work out.
Mm-hmm. And you write about terrible things happening in some of these starter home communities and some of the upper-end communities. A lot of crime, bullets coming in through windows, a lot of social disorder.
Now, I obviously don't want to overplay this because you know, this is not meant to be a scare tactic. It's just meant to get your attention.
And it
did. It's obviously not happening in every single new community, but it goes back to how fragile these places are. And if people walk away from their home and their mortgage, many times that house goes into limbo. And the bank doesn't have it. The bank may not know that they're about to get it. The local jurisdiction doesn't know what's going on. And sometimes, again, these are just anecdotal evidence that people start, you know, squatters move in, and sometimes some pretty violent squatters.
Mm-hmm. You talk about, and it's probably good to have a little history lesson here, how do we happen to live in all these suburbs? Whose dream was this?
Well, this is our dream. This is the American dream of the industrial era. Keep in mind that the industrial era, how we made our living was pretty nasty. It was dirty. was noisy. It was polluting. It was just not a good thing to be around. And also, a third of what we made in this country related to the automobile. Literally, a third of our jobs, directly and indirectly, related to building the cars, providing the raw material that became the cars, pumping the oil that became the gasoline, building the roads, insuring the cars, financing the cars, everything, maintaining the cars. All of this was about a third of how we made our living. So if you were to see the USA in your Chevrolet, you were going to be helping yourself financially. And this is how the American dream seems to have always played out on the ground. It happened before in the 19th century, you know, the yeoman farmer, 40 acres and a mule kind of thing, that the American dream plays out on the ground consistent with the underlying economy. So here in the industrial era, the best way that people really got this into their minds and really into their hearts, the best way to understand it is if you know about the 1939 World's Fair in New York City. It was a exhibit at this fair that was the most popular exhibit at what was the most popular World's Fair in history, and that exhibit was called Futurama. And Futurama laid out this future of, you know, the distant future of 1960, where people would have their own house on their own lot,
right,
that they would get there by car, and cities would become more and more antiseptic, and buildings separated to let air and light in. And in essence, it was, you know, proclaiming the future of the suburbs. So we got that in our heads. And after the Second World War, as it was brewing during the Second World War, coming out of the Second World War, we put that on the ground, and we wanted it. This is no conspiracy. We wanted it.
It's the way I grew up. You know, the house was plot. You found the plot in the middle of a cornfield, and this whole community sprung up. It was my parents' dream. You know,
exactly.
They couldn't have been happier.
It was my parents' dream, too. And so that was reflected, by the way, I'm not going to ask your age, of course, but I'll say, I'm in my mid-50s, and back in the 1950s, I would be watching Leave it to Beaver, and in the 1960s, I'd be watching Dick Van Dyke, and in the 1970s, The Brady Bunch, and all these sitcoms set in the suburbs. Then you would go and turn on in the 1980s, you know, Hill Street Blues, which showed urban problems and blight and, you know, unsolvable problems. And, you know, The Blade Runner as a movie and, you know, Escape from New York as a movie. So we had this image of the city that was not really positive, and we had the image of the suburbs is where all happy endings happened. Took place. And now fast forward to the 90s, and my kids were listening to and watching Seinfeld and Friends and Sex and the City, and all of a sudden, urban life, walkable urban life, became a much different concept for them. So this is a trend being driven by Gen Xers and by the millennials. And, you know, probably the first major trend that the baby boomers are in the caboose.
Yeah, exactly. And when you talk about walkable urban life, you go beyond what we think of when we think of urban cities, downtown areas and urban cities. You're also looking at communities that have a center to them that you can walk to, right?
Exactly. It doesn't have to take place in downtowns as we conceive of it, that there's a phenomenal range of options in walkable urban communities. They can go from, if you remember Back to the Future, the movie, I always have my graduate students watch it. I realize I demonstrate just how tough a teacher I am. But it shows two kinds of places in the same place, 1955 Hill Valley, 1985 Hill Valley. And 1955 Hill Valley, with its downtown, was a walkable urban place in a very small town that couldn't be more than 25,000 people. And so it goes from that to Midtown Manhattan, which is many, many times denser. And so there's something for everybody in this vast range of walkable urban places, and so they don't always take place downtown. I did a survey out of Brookings in December and looked at the top 30 metro areas in the country in population and counted the regionally significant walkable urban places that are there, and found of the 157 places that I found that 50% were in the suburbs and 50% were in the center city.
Hmm. You also did a survey, or you quote somebody who did a survey that asked the question, how do we want to live? And it is amazing how many of us want to have those walkable urban centers.
Yes, most of the surveys that you hear about how people want to live, I find ask very simplistic questions. This survey, done by a colleague of mine at the University of Michigan, Jonathan Levine, did what is known as trade-off analysis, asking the 1,600 people that he talked to in Boston and in Atlanta, would you rather have a big house on a big lot, but you have to drive everywhere, versus a smaller house on a small lot or no lot, but you could walk to lots of services? And asked a whole series of questions similar to that. As they say, it's a trade-off analysis methodology. And he found that roughly a third want drivable suburban, roughly a third want walkable urban, and roughly a third will either put up with both of them or they don't know what they want.
What about these McMansions, the McMansion subdivisions? They're 30, 40 miles out of the cities. I assume people have to commute long distances and pay a lot of money for gasoline. They're pretty far from their neighbors. Some of them have four-car garages.
Yes, exactly.
You know, I was hearing yesterday about one of these that has a special room for the dog, so when the dog comes in, he or she can have a shower. There's a shower for the dog. All right, what's happening with these? Why were they attractive to people, and what's their future?
Well, again, it's a free country, so people can go ahead and do anything that they want. And the problem I do have with much of the fringe development, however, is that it's being massively, massively subsidized.
Hmm.
So that infrastructure that allows them to get out there, they are having the general taxpayer pay for it. And it is 10 to 20 times more. They should be paying literally 10 to 20 times more than what they're paying now for that infrastructure. And so that I have a problem with, of course. I don't like subsidies. I think they make bad economic decisions. But assuming that they pay their own way out there, that's just fine that they live out there. The thing is that, as I mentioned at the top of the hour, that we in real estate seem to overdo things, and we've overdone these things. And so one survey that came out in 2006 showed that over the next 20 years, 40% of large lot single-family housing will become obsolete, that there'll be no market for it.
Mm-hmm.
And now nobody's going to bulldoze those places. What will happen is that they will drop precipitously in value. And so you'll see a lot of great bargains out on the fringe, but you'll be paying $3, $4, $5, $6 a gallon in gasoline to get there. You have to heat these huge volumes of space. And you may have neighbors that don't quite fit the Leave It to Beaver image.
Mm-hmm. So they may be bulldozed.
Well, again, it's hard to speculate at this point. I do know that they're very cheaply built.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the last time we went through this structural change was back in the 50s and 60s when we abandoned our cities. And most of the housing that we abandoned was incredibly well built, back at the turn of the last century up until 1930. And, you know, very solid walls with, you know, large studs that were supporting the place, brick and stone as a veneer for, and maybe even built out of brick and stone, and hardwood floors and solid doors and all that good stuff.
Right.
Well, the McMansions tend to be very poorly built. Not all of them, of course. But, and particularly the starter homes are incredibly poorly built.
Mm-hmm.
That I once came up to a starter home that a friend of mine was building when there was a windstorm coming up. He just had the wood frame up, and he was rushing to put up the drywall. And I said, what's the problem with this? I mean, why are you rushing to do this? And he said, that windstorm will knock this, will knock those sticks down, will knock the frame down, that we're putting up the drywall to give it its structural stability. So this, you know, these houses, particularly if they get converted to rental, and, you know, we know that rental apartments or rooming houses take a lot of wear and tear.
Mm-hmm.
People don't care for rentals the way they care for their own house. And so these houses are going to be, they are not going to have a very long life as far as a rental.
Let's welcome phone calls for Christopher. Christopher Leinberger is our guest, has a fascinating article in the March issue of The Atlantic. The next slum, the subprime crisis, is just the tip of the iceberg. Fundamental changes in American life may turn today's McMansions into tomorrow's tenements. He's also the author of Option of Urbanism, Investing in a New America, published by Island Press, and is a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution. Well, he does all kinds of things. He's a land use strategist and developer. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. This should be fun. You know, we can talk now about where it is we live and if we've chosen to live in certain areas, if we're unhappy with the choice that we made. Maybe we moved to a suburban area to fulfill the American dream, and now it's not very close to, well, within walking distance, restaurants or libraries, et cetera. So we're looking at new places. Maybe you've changed the way that you live. What about these McMansion areas? What about sustainable, walkable urban places? Do you live in one of those? What do you think of those? Well, join us. We'd love to hear from you. 800-486-8655 in Milwaukee, 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050 for you to join our conversation. Our guest says in the article that there has been a swing back toward urban living, and there are many reasons to believe this swing will continue. Many low-density suburbs and McMansion subdivisions, including some that are lovely and affluent today, may become what inner cities became in the 60s and 70s, slums characterized by poverty, crime, and decay. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Go to phone calls now at 800-486-8655. Christopher Leinberger, our guest, and Tim from Green Bay is our first caller. Christopher, hi, Tim.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
The professor was speaking about urbanization, that I couldn't help but think longitudinally as with if there's a correlation between franchises and the move towards urban areas or suburbs, and if you could speak about how franchises maybe could be correlated to any of this.
Okay.
Does this mean, do you think franchises as in fast food franchises,
right,
restaurant franchises?
Yeah, the move away from mom-and-pop stores, malls, and all of that.
That actually is, yes, that's an interesting point, and I address this in a chapter in the book, that there is a, what we've done in this country is that we've commoditized real estate development, that we've taken what used to be a very local-oriented business, and we've turned it into a national commodity market, and it's what I refer to as the 19 standard product types that we in real estate can easily build, that we know how to build, and that are financeable on Wall Street. And so a classic one is what's known as a grocery store anchored neighborhood center that you'd share with 25,000 of your closest neighbors. And it would be anchored by a 50, 60,000 square foot national credit grocery store. The other end of the center would be a 20, 25,000 square foot national franchise credit rated drugstore, and all the stores in between would be those great stores that you know and love, such as I Can't Believe It's Yogurt and your Hallmark card shopping. And these things would all be built in a 12 to 15 acre piece of land that would be on the going home side of a very busy arterial that would have at least 25,000 cars per day. It'd be set back from the street by about 150 feet. It would have 20% of that lot covered by retail. The rest would be asphalt. And at the last 15 minutes of design time, the developer would ask the architect, where is this? And if they said it's Southern California, they'd put those little Mediterranean tiles on the roof.
Wow.
And if they said it was Washington, D.C., they make it look like a Williamsburg sort of place. These are all the same places filled with the same tenants, and it's because it's been commoditized. So what Tim brings up is a very important, compelling feature for suburban development, because all these places are meant for the suburbs.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Tim, for the call. Karen from Stevens Point. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
Good morning. Can you hear me all right?
Yeah, the phone's not great, but we can hear you.
Let me do something quick here. Is that better?
Yes, it is.
Okay. I'd like to speak to the racial component of this suburban flight back to the cities, cities that were abandoned to the poor, mostly the poor blacks. You know, we look at what's been happening in New Orleans, where big developers have wanted to go in and tear down the tenement housing, and basically the people becoming homeless so that these developers can sell and develop the inner city. The same thing has happened in Oakland, in Chicago, and it's, you know, it's a source of conflict now in Washington, D.C., where perfectly good buildings and schools are being let go so that the developers can claim that they're no longer, well, basically so they can be bulldozed and these expensive things for whites can can be built up. And so unless we also provide low-cost housing for the poor folks, I'm afraid we're just acting like somewhat like spoiled children. Well, I didn't want it then, but I want it back now.
Interesting point, Christopher.
Yes, I deal a lot with this in the book, that the race has been a major driver of how we've built our cities, certainly over the last 50, 60, 70 years. And I point out that if you know three things about our metropolitan area over the last 50 years, if you know where the local white upper-middle-income housing concentration is, and it does tend to concentrate, if you know where the local minority housing concentrates, and if you know the freeway systems, well, you pretty much know where 70 to 90% of all job growth has gone, most of the infrastructure investment has been made, and it goes into what I refer to as the favored quarter. And smack dab in the favored quarter, which is a 90-degree arc going out of downtown, smack dab in the favored quarter is that upper-middle-income white housing district. And so we've been building our metropolitan areas based upon race for many, many decades. And our affordable housing program today in this country is summed up by the phrase, drive until you qualify. So if you just drive another 30 minutes each way, you'll be able to find a cheaper place to live. And, of course, you'll be destroying the planet and not spending a whole lot of time with your family in the process. So we don't have an effective affordable housing problem. So I absolutely agree with the caller that we need a conscious affordable housing strategy as walkable urban development takes place, because my model of walkable urban development is not the Upper East Side of Manhattan. It is a mixed-income community that we've never really achieved in the last 100 years in this country. We used to do it all the time, by the way. When we built walkable urban places back in the mid-19th century, the mid-18th century, that they were mixed income. The suburban flight to the fringe, and people were seduced by, you can live with what I refer to as JLUs, just like us. And that seduction drew people out of the city. Most people, not all, but most people who want to live in walkable urban places, I find, want it to be mixed income, but that means we need a conscious strategy to make that happen.
Yeah. Thank you so much. What a good point, Karen. You mentioned, and I don't know much about this, I'm sure there's more about it in the book, this walkable development, the granddaddy of all lifestyle centers, the Reston Town Center between Virginia's Dulles International Airport and Washington, D.C. Does this combine the features of affordable housing and more upper-income housing or not?
Nope, not at all. It's a private sector project, and it is all market-rate housing. There has been no interest on the part of Fairfax County, which is a very wealthy county, to encourage the developers to have affordable housing. And the developers, you know, they viewed back in the late 80s when they were starting this that, my Lord, we're trying to do something that nobody's ever done before. In the middle of a cornfield, we're going to put in a high-density, walkable urban place, and that's a big enough mountain to climb than to also try to solve social problems that the society doesn't care about. Now, go across the river, and Montgomery County on the Maryland side, which is the equivalent of Fairfax County, both very high-income counties, they've taken the approach that upwards of 20% of all new housing must be affordable. And they've had this in place for 25 years, and they've built tens of thousands of affordable housing units that wouldn't have been, and they're right in place. Most of them, not all of them, are incorporated with the market rate housing. So there's a model there in Montgomery County that's a national model. It's best in class in the country as far as what's known as inclusionary zoning.
And then the schools are close too, so they're integrated and.
Again, I'm not going to say that issue, neither Fairfax nor Montgomery do a good job of that.
Right.
The school system, it's been a disgrace in my mind that we have continued to look at schools from a purely efficiency point of view and from a legalistic point of view since we've built these suburbs that are so anti-children. We think of suburbs as being great child-friendly places. Your child growing up in the suburbs has a much greater chance of dying or being injured in a suburban environment than in the worst ghetto in
really?
The country.
How so?
Because of the kids killing themselves with cars at age 16.
Oh, my.
And they get just as many drugs as anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you look at the statistics, and if you want to, you know, find the safest place to raise your kid, it's in a walkable urban place. And so one of the things we've done with our schools is that most school systems now, it is not possible to walk to school. And I found this out first when I was driving in an Atlanta suburb early one morning, and a school bus stopped for a little girl. Little girl, you know, I was behind it. Little girl got in. The bus started moving again and immediately turned left into the school across the street.
Oh, my gosh.
And so I called up the school district and said,
no.
Give me a break. What is this? And they said, it's not legal for any kid to walk to school because it's too dangerous because all the roads are too busy.
Oh,
so I don't know about you, but I did a little back-of-the-envelope calculation a few years back. My 12 years in public school outside of Philadelphia, I walked 2,200 miles going to and from school. Now, of course, both ways were uphill. as I tell my kids.
And that's why you're so healthy today, right, Christopher?
Well, I mean, 2,200 miles that we're not allowing kids to walk.
Well, I see your point. Yes, it's a good point.
I mean, childhood obesity is, if you excuse the pun, the great underbelly, the weak underbelly of this society.
Well, that's quite a story. The school was across the street. Whew. Greg is next from Watertown. Hi, Greg.
Good morning. Good morning, Kathleen, and welcome back.
Thank you, Greg.
One quick comment about urban sprawl is, that is going to become a huge liability for the owners, for the government, for everybody involved as the price of oil and other amenities continue to rise in a world where we have only a limited amount of certain resources. That's just going to be a huge liability for the future. But my main comment, I'd like to talk a little bit about the social value of traditional neighborhood design and the type of neighborhood that I grew up in. And my example would be, when I was a kid, we used to play kick the can and moonlight, starlight, running through everybody's backyards and in the middle of the street. And you could bet that Mrs. Brenneke was going to watch the kids when they were in her yard, and Mrs. Breunig would watch them in her yard. And if I skinned my knee, there would be a phone call to my mom explaining that Greg's coming home and his knee's all bloody. And this type of social value is not even recognized by today's generation. They've never experienced this sort of thing, and they don't even know that this value exists. And it's part of the social capital that makes our society really thrive and function that is being lost. And what really kind of scares me is the fact that so many people don't even know that this type of social capital and value exists.
Greg, you obviously grew up in my neighborhood. Same exact thing. And you're exactly right that, you know, the kids today are so programmed, they must be chauffeur. You know, one thing to keep in mind is that more than a third of us, and actually pushing 40%, do not drive in this society. That they're too old, they're too young, they're too handicapped, they're too poor, as we saw in New Orleans. And so the other 60%, or the other two-thirds, have to drive them. And this is where soccer moms came into being. And therefore, the kids have to be so programmed, and they never get a chance to experience the world on their own. It's always in a very controlled environment, scheduled by mom and dad. And then at age 18, they go off to college and, you know, and they're on their own. It is really a shame, and it is. I don't think it's quite the way to raise kids. I think kids raised in a walkable urban place, a traditional neighborhood, whether it be a lower density walkable urban suburb that is close to a downtown, or whether it's a high density, you know, the Upper West Side of New York, far better way to raise a child.
Thanks, Greg, for your call. Edith from Madison, hi.
Yes, hi, good morning. I am absolutely taken with your guest, but I have a couple of comments and a question. Out here in Madison, we are surrounded by communities of starter homes, which are built on former farms, which are flat as a pancake. It is just a vision of ugliness all over. But my question regards the subprime mortgage. Correct me if I'm incorrect in my assumption. The prime lending rate, I believe, is the rate that is given to government for loans?
Well, the lowest rate is given to government because you don't pay taxes on government debt.
Okay, but how was it that such a thing as a subprime rate came into being anyway for a mortgage? And then how does a subprime rate mortgage relate to ARMs, adjustable rate mortgages, which actually, after we got over the stagflation of the Carter years and mortgages rather settled down into rates which people could manage, why would anybody fall for an ARM?
The reason is, well, A, people were thinking short term when they agreed to take the teaser rates up front that were so very low. But the main problem behind the subprime mortgage crisis is that those people making those loans weren't responsible if people went belly up. There was no downside because they would sell the they would make the loan, and then they'd sell the mortgage to another institution. and they got the complicit consent of the rating agencies back on Wall Street to, you know, by the slicing and dicing that you may have heard of, that they got these great credit ratings for mortgages that were not so great. And they basically pulled the wool over the eyes of these investors. So, you know, they were stupid.
It, was that what you were referring to a while ago by referring to this industry as now a commodity?
That happened actually beforehand, but yes, it is related to the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
That they took mortgages, you know, your mortgage and other people's mortgages, and they put them into a form that is the equivalent of a Class A Intel stock.
Uh-huh.
Stock certificate, or a pork belly,
uh-huh.
which is, you know, a grade A pork belly. You know, one grade A pork belly is the same as the second grade A pork belly. Well, it's the same thing with these mortgage packages,
right.
Only they rigged the game with the rating agencies, and they fooled the rating agencies, and then the investors were fooled. The people making the mortgages.
Banks are failing. Everything's going on because of it. Shouldn't Congress regulate all that?
Either Congress needs to regulate that, and of course it's your classic, close the barn door after the horses are out. But certainly Congress should, or the Treasury, or the Federal Reserve, and I'm sure that they are doing their damnedest now to put in more, tighter regulations.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Edith, very much for your call. We need to pause for a moment. We're talking with Christopher Leinberger this hour of the program, author of a piece in the March issue of The Atlantic, The Next Slum. The subprime crisis is just the tip of the iceberg. Fundamental changes in American life may turn today's McMansions into tomorrow's tenements. Did I give you our – oh, I also want to tell you he's author of Option of Urbanism, Investing in a New America, just published. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up tomorrow during this time period, we'll talk about that study just released that looks at high school students and where they have gaps in knowledge that might be significant gaps. Okay. Let's go back to phone calls for Christopher. 800-486-8655. Al is calling from Atlanta. Hi, Al.
Hey there. How you doing?
All right. How are you?
Just fine. I've been listening to your programs, and I see that you have a myriad of issues there, number one being the McMansions. It has always struck me rather strange that the people that are green will go live in a house that they have wasted material that they could have built at least three or four houses out of, and they can only use portions of it, and most of it is just for looks. That's the first thing, which I think that the young man that you have on, I think we kind of share the thing that these large houses are out of place. Number two, schools. In my state, which is the one that he mentioned, which is the Atlanta area, we found out that the school systems, and as a matter of fact, they normally take roughly about 75% of our taxes for schools, and there's no accountability for this. And we found that there were quite a few things that they were doing with the money other than schools. And when my kids were small, we brought them all home, homeschooled them, and at the time, which was 10, 15 years ago, they didn't allow kids that were educated at home to go to schools. But once we put them in school, they were all in college grade levels. They got in school, and within the span of about 6 months, they were dumbfounded to believe that they couldn't do simple algebra. And I pointed out to them that they've been doing this since they were about, 7, 8, because I more or less just taught them on that level. And number three, the white flight as known there, I think most people are beginning to hopefully see that there's no reason for white flight, because we, just as they, look for the same values that they have, because I have noticed in the times that I've lived that basically there is no difference in what they want for their kids, for their communities, or what I want for my kids and my community.
Christopher.
Well, first I want to say thank you for calling me a young man. I will take that anytime. The issue of these very large houses, and, I just go back to the fact that people, it is a free country, and if they want a large house, that's certainly their option. And what we're finding, by the way, is a lot of immigrants moving to this country are now going immediately to the suburbs, to large housing, and, you know, coming from China, coming from Mexico, coming from other places, they want to live this, what I consider the old American dream as well. And I don't think we can stop them. It's just that, you know, now that I'm in the phase of life where I'm looking to downsize, having a smaller place and is just heaven as far as I'm concerned. But it's a personal decision. As far as the schools go, we've been one of the reasons that the suburbs became JLUs, just like us kind of places, is obviously because of schools. And what many suburban school districts have done is that they've zoned out people that are not JLUs, in particular people that are living in, say, rental apartments, because the school taxes that rental apartment pays doesn't cover the cost of the actually educating that child that is coming from that rental apartment. And besides, the folks that are living in the single-family houses don't want poorer people going to their schools. So what it's done is it has obviously isolated us, and many times it has concentrated poverty. And one of the things we've learned over the last 20 years is that concentrated poverty is to be avoided at all cost, because concentrated poverty leads to significant social problems, and it doesn't matter who you are. If you're in a concentrated poor neighborhood, the school scores go down, the social indicators all go out of whack. Mm-hmm. So, and then as far as white flight, that's been, as I mentioned at the top of the hour, that if you knew three things about any metropolitan area, where the white upper middle income housing district is, where the local minority housing is, and where the freeways are over the last 50 years, you pretty much know how the place grew.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Al, very much for the call. So are you looking to downsize, Christopher, or have you done it?
Yeah, we're in a townhouse right now within four blocks. I gave myself four blocks from the Brookings Institution.
Mm-hmm.
My wife works at the Phillips Collection, which is a modern art museum, two blocks away, and my publisher's three blocks away.
Oh, my gosh.
What an
arrangement.
Nice. And our next move is into a flat, which is probably, I'm guessing, is in a place called the West End of D.C., which is about four blocks from where I'm sitting right now.
Great. Eugene, hi.
Good morning, Kathleen and Professor. I bought one of these McMansions about 40 years ago. 41 years ago in a small town in southwestern Wisconsin. There's about 14 or 15 rooms in it. I think I was 27 years old. I bought
it
on a default more than anything else. By the time I was 30, I had it paid for. But we had a tornado came through here a couple of years ago, and it made kindling wood out of a couple of houses around us. And this old house, it just never touched it. It took a few shingles off the roof. Now, the place, the small village is a nice place to live, but at the same time, my mother and dad bought a small restaurant here in 1954, and those buildings are all gone. In this small town of about 700, I can count 9 businesses on the south side of the street that are gone. We had 3 grocery stores. They are no longer here. We got a small one 6 miles north of us where we can go, or we have to go 13 miles west or 22 miles east to do any shopping at all. We just haven't. The only business I think left here is main business, keeping track of everybody else's business. That's a while too.
Yeah, Christopher.
That's a reflection of, and in particular, the business question is a reflection of this commodification of real estate. And on the retail side, again, there are 19 standard product types. 5 or 6 of them are retail. And what's happened in the retail business is that we've obviously gravitated towards bigger and bigger format retail distribution. And bigger format retail distribution means that you have a wider trade area. And that wider trade area, you know, it started back 40 years ago, you know, going back to your little town, is that the trade radius would be 1 to 2 miles from that little downtown, and those small stores could support themselves on 1 to 2 miles. And today, a big box retail center has a trade radius of anywhere from 7 to 15 miles.
Hmm.
And it basically acts as a neutron bomb on any small retailer that tries to compete against them in that 7 to 15 mile radius. So it wipes them out. So what we're finding is in these walkable urban places, two things are happening. One is that we're seeing the reemergence of small retail. Within two blocks of me, I've got a little grocery store that some Koreans run, a dry cleaner, a little hardware store, lots of little restaurants, most of them mom and pop. Then within about five blocks of me, we've got about, 100 restaurants. Some of them are, you know, and they're all mom and pops, by the way. We don't have any chains at all.
Mm.
And so we're seeing the reemergence of locally based retail. We sort of had a generation or two where we really didn't create retailers in this country, and there's now a demand for them to come back. But the big boxes are also discovering the strength of the urban market. And about a mile from us, a new Target and a Best Buy is just about to open.
Oh, my.
Right on top of a new metro stop. So, you know, it's part of the subway system, right on top of it. And there's a big box giant food store that went across the street. And so the big boxes are beginning to understand how to come back into these tight, and this is a two-story Target, by the way, all with decked parking and very little parking. Most people get there on foot.
Hmm.
And they're going to have a cartilator, if you know what that is.
No, what is it?
I have yet to see one.
What is it?
Well, you have a escalator for people, and next to you is a cartilator for your cart to go up to the second floor.
Oh.
So, you know, the big boxes, some of them, are beginning to understand how to come into tight, high-density, walkable urban places.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Eugene, very much for the call. Let's go to Laura from Green Bay. Hi, Laura.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm just calling to tell you that I live in an old urban neighborhood in Green Bay that has somehow managed to survive this process. My kids walk a couple blocks to school. My husband is 10 minutes from back door to his desk. There's a grocery store nearby. There's got to be at least a half a dozen churches within walking distance and a couple of hospitals that are thriving. There's a museum. There's parks. There's young families with children. There's retired people. My next-door neighbor is a retired school teacher. It's economically diverse, and it's racially diverse, gay and lesbian couples. It's really kind of this interesting neighborhood, and I really like living here, but it's had to be protected quite diligently by the people who live here. It's taken back in like the 70s and 80s, I think it was teetering on the brink of becoming, kind of a blighted area. And instead, it's been protected by the families who live here. And I'd like to say it's thriving. I mean, it's suffering like some neighborhoods are now from lots of houses for sale, but it's filled with beautiful old homes. And not all of them are big, expensive homes. It's quite different. There's smaller homes. There's some rental, and we're really rather proud of it, frankly.
I can tell. It sounds good, Christopher.
Well, you know, I'm guessing that neighborhood was probably built back in the early 20th century, up until the 20s.
Some of them are even older than that.
Mm-hmm. And late 19th century, early 20th century, we in real estate really figured out how to build great neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm.
And they used to build statues, believe it or not, to the real estate developers who built those neighborhoods.
Oh my gosh.
In certain places. Think of that.
Think of that.
but they were referred to as town founders then.
Mm.
They weren't rape and pillage real estate developers like we think of them today. And it really was the height of what we learned about how to build great walkable urban places. And then in the 30s and into the early 40s with the war, we in this country virtually built nothing.
Hmm.
The building permits dropped by 80% over that 15-year period over the 1920s. And all the people that were in real estate went out of business, or they died, or they went off to war and came back and did something different. And we got collective amnesia in that 15-year period. Tremendous pent-up demand for housing. You know, huge housing shortages in the late 40s into the 1950s. And we created this mechanized approach, this Levittown approach. I think it's ironic that last week the Levitt company went bankrupt. And we began down this path of this suburban, you know, it was the last structural shift as we began to build these very low-density, car-dominated places, which, mm-hmm. again, we wanted to do. Mm-hmm. There's no conspiracy here. And places like the Caller's neighborhood, which, again, sounds very much like how, you know, a place I grew up in, which had lots of income diversity, and you walked everywhere.
Mm-hmm. We're almost out of time, just to let you know.
That those places held on by their fingernails during the 70s and 80s, and now they are just golden.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Christopher.
But it takes management. It takes those community groups. It's a much more complex kind of place.
We got to go. Thank you so much for being with us. It was such a good hour. Thanks.
Good.
Christopher Leinberger is, you can go to the Atlantic Monthly, The Next Slum is the article, and his book is The Option of Urbanism, Investing in a New America, published by Island Press. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, to John Tretter for on-air production. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.